Well, good evening and welcome to the late debate. I'm Katie Hannan, and joining us in Studio 10 tonight, we have James Lawless, Fianna Fáil TD for Kildare North and Chair of the Oireachtas Justice Committee, Labour Senator and Party Housing Spokesperson Rebecca Moynihan, Mick Barry, Solidarity and Socialist Party TD for Cork North Central, and in an adjoining studio, Aoife Moore, Political Correspondent with the Irish Examiner, and later we'll be joined from our Cork studio by David Lockery from Bruce College. We want to hear from you, so please do get in touch. You can text us on 51551. You can email us on latedebate@rte.ie, or you can tweet to @latedebate_RTE. Well, after yesterday's drama, this evening came a very sobering assessment of where we currently stand with the coronavirus. Here is Professor Philip Nolan, Chair of NPHET's Modelling Group, at this evening's briefing in the Department of Health.
I am more concerned at this point in time than I have been at any point in time since late April. I'm concerned about the rise in cases, the pattern of the disease, the reproduction number, and what our scenario models tell us about what will happen in the next couple of weeks if each and every one of us doesn't change the manner in which we're managing our contacts and the risk of disease.
And that was Professor Nolan a few hours ago at that briefing. Very sobering assessment there, James Lawless. I don't think anybody doubts but that we're heading towards level three in Dublin this weekend. But given what he's saying there, given what we saw in that letter that was released that went to the minister from the CMO on Friday, can you explain to me why it took until yesterday for those extra restrictions to be introduced for Dublin?
Yeah, so look, we're looking at Dublin possibly being on the verge of increased restrictions. It already has some because the wet pubs won't be opening in Dublin, unlike the rest of the country where they open on the 21st. I think the governor caught between a rock and a hard place. There's been criticism in recent weeks that they were slaves to NPHET and they were following the advice religiously and they weren't even translating it sufficiently or you know, making their own of it. I think maybe this weekend they've struck back a little bit and said, look, there's a trouble coming down the tracks in terms of the rates in Dublin, the incidence numbers. There was advice, I think, given on Friday to say restrict gatherings in homes from three households to two. And they didn't act on that immediately. They sat on that for a couple of days.
Was that a right thing to do?
Well, I think, as I said, they're caught between the devil and the deep blue sea. You know, if they jump to NPHET's tune, they're seen as being overly compliant and not being political and not standing up for the wider economy. If they take a couple of days to consider the impact of a decision, they're damned as well. So I think there's a balance here.
We heard when we're talking about what we're talking about, which is an exponential increase, you know, numbers doubling in a matter of days, and as it was described there by Professor Nolan, you know, we could be facing into, if this continues, if we are on this trajectory, if we were at the higher end of it, if we were at 1.7 or 1.8, our number, 1,000 cases a day by the middle of next month.
Sure.
Surely so, every hour and every day matters in that. So sitting back and saying, let's just see how it goes for a few days.
So I suppose I've been on the other end of this because I'm a Kildare representative and we were locked down for 3 weeks for a second lockdown over and beyond what the whole country
went through. And it achieved what it was supposed to achieve.
Well, the outbreaks were contained. It's arguable the outbreaks may have been contained in other ways. But as somebody who studied the stats in some detail through that, as I did, you could see, for example, that the day that Leith and Offaly were released from lockdown and Kildare was kept in, the Kildare case rates were very high. The next day and the next 7 days, they were falling rapidly. So sometimes it is worth standing back and letting the stats talk for a couple of days. Sometimes it is actually worth seeing what the mutations manifest and seeing where the numbers go. And I think the other point about this is we're moving to a stage, and as the government launched yesterday, Living with COVID, we are going to be living with COVID for probably 18 months, maybe 2 years longer. There is a balance between advisory and mandatory. So I think the government and all the officials were very clear over the weekend and today and last week saying Dublin is in trouble. Dublin's going the wrong direction. I think there's a message, and people in Dublin are big enough and bold enough and mature enough to hear that message and say, do you know what, guys? We better be careful out there. We better take steps just to manage our own distancing and our own interactions. And I think we're probably going to begin moving towards
that. That message, though, James, came much more directly from Ronan Glenn, who put out his own video on social media on Friday evening, clearly extremely concerned that the advice that had been given to the government in terms of increasing those restrictions for Dublin had not been acted on, had been they had been delayed in terms of, and actually went to took the measure of going and producing his own video and putting it out to warn people that this is a really serious situation.
Yeah, so look,
does that not say that there is a serious issue here in terms of...
No, it says that Ronan Glynn is an excellent professional, health person, but also communicator. I watched his video, and it was really well put together. He also did a similar piece for us in Kildare when we were locked down. He had a number of conference calls with the local representatives, including the council teams. And he does that, and he goes over and above, and plaudits to him for doing that. But I don't think, I think it's a stretch to suggest that because he chose to make a presentation that there's some kind of rift between him and government. I don't think that's the case at all. I think in actual fact it's a case of it's a team effort here and everybody's bringing their own individual skills and strengths to bear. And I think we are, in my own personal view, I don't know if government share it is, we need to move more towards that kind of advisory model. Because I think the idea of having guarded checkpoints on the M50 or indeed on the N7 as it was in Kildare at one point isn't really sustainable. And people are mature enough to understand it. If we give people the information, if we give people the data, and that's one thing I've been calling for months now, give people the localised detailed data so that we can understand, taking the case of Dublin, if Balbriggan has a spike, does that mean that Cabinteely and Rathcoole are also in trouble? It may well not. And I think it's more about understanding the communities, how people live, work and socialise, okay, and their patterns of movement, and bringing in restrictions around those. But people themselves are actually often best judged to understand that and modify accordingly. And we need to bring people with us on all this stuff.
Okay. Rebecca, would you accept what James Lawless is saying there, that sometimes it's more helpful to sit back, give the numbers a few days to see where they go, and then act?
Absolutely, and I agree with James in terms of, I think if you give people the data, I think they can clearly see where their outbreaks. Dublin is a very populous county. So where you have an outbreak in one area, it's not necessarily going to transfer. And I think if people are aware that it's in their own area, they are going to change their behaviour accordingly. But I do think that there is a problem with how the government communicated their big announcement yesterday. And we ended up getting caught involved in what was a political mess and the real issue, which was the numbers are growing. We're beginning to get very concerned about this and we're worried about next week and the week and the week after. That is a real concern. And I think since this new government has taken over, I don't think that they've had the same very strong and clear message as we had, let's say, at the beginning of March.
But just to go back to the point, because we will get to that, obviously, later in the programme, but you don't have any issue with the government holding back on those extra restrictions from Dublin that they were advised to implement last Friday from the CMO?
I think the problem was Dublin is neither a level 2 or a level 3. And I think that Dublin, the country is a level 2 with these extra restrictions in Dublin, is the main problem. And I think that gets very, very confused. In terms of the government sitting back and having a look and considering the wider implications of it, I don't have any problem with that.
Okay. Mick, Barry, would you agree with that?
Not really. When I hear senior medical people say that they're more concerned about the position than they have been at any time since April, and when I read in the letter about a reservoir of disease, I mean, when I step off the train now, I really put my head in gear. I know that I'm going from Cork to Dublin. I'm going from an area which has a relatively low level of the virus at the moment to an area that has a significantly higher level. I think Dublin probably is a level 3 at this stage. The question maybe is not so much, can Dublin avoid level 3? The question is, can Dublin avoid level 4? And I think you'll need to go into level 3 and have a really vigorous campaign in order to take the threat of level 4 off the agenda. I hear the point that's being made about, you know, giving it a day or two. And I'm not unsympathetic to that point of view. I don't think that there is a rift between NPHET and the government, but I think there are very definite tensions. Because
is that not healthy, though?
It can be, but there is an element to it that's not. And the question is, to what extent are the government influenced by pressure from business interests who want to put the question of profit above the issue of health and safety?
Well, maybe they're putting the question of survival for many people and their businesses into the frame as well.
Maybe they are, but the health question needs to be put to the forefront, because apart from anything else, If you don't act swiftly on the health issue and you move through level 3 into level 4, what effect does that have on the economy?
In the line of that, this extra layer that's now being introduced, this new committee that's going to be chaired by Martin Fraser, that's going to somehow be some kind of implementation body in between NPHET and the Cabinet. Surely that is diluting the public health advice with other considerations.
Well, I think I heard a line during the week that Martin Fraser's team were going to water the whiskey for the Cabinet. I don't know where I said that, but I heard it said during the week. I think the idea is that you need to have an everyman in the room, or an every woman, someone that can sort of say, well, this might work in practice, but will it work in theory? The famous quote. Sometimes the recommendations that come from NPHET in the past have been very detailed. They have been very onerous. And at times, there is a balancing act. I mean, the weddings is a good example. I mean, people say, you know, and as a public representative, I'm sure all of us around the table, every time there's an announcement, every time there's the Taoiseach or the Taoiseach or Minister Donnelly goes on TV, and actually it was always this, when it was Simon Harris going on TV 3 months ago, it was the exact same. Our phones explode and our social media pages go on fire. People say, how does this work? What about this situation? What about these boundary situations? And there's a large degree of, I suppose, common sense on the fringes. But the weddings is a good example, because the government said all the way through, you cannot meet in groups above a certain size, but it's okay for weddings. Now, let's be realistic. The weddings are not any safer or any less public health risk than any other gathering might be it a football team or be it a 21st birthday
in
party.
In many
or
ways, you'd say worse, actually.
Worse, because look at the whole idea is a celebration.
All about love and touching.
Yeah, loving and coming together and hugging and kissing and being friends and getting together and a few drinks into the mix. But they've made a call to say weddings are important. People have planned maybe for years. This is a really special day for the couple and their families. We're going to make this calculated risk to say you can have your wedding. We're not going to have brides cancelling as happened in the previous lockdown the night before. So government has to take NPHET recommendation. NPHET have an obligation to provide the best possible public health advice, but equally government have an obligation to manage, mitigate that, and move it into a kind of real-world scenario.
Okay. I just want to bring Aoife in, because I'm conscious, Aoife, that you're not sitting in front of me. But you're part of our debate, Aoife.
Yeah, I'm out in Siberia here.
Aoife, what's the feeling about this evening in Leinster House in terms of how fast or slow the government moved on this, what we're facing into, and this new committee that's being introduced into the mix?
Yeah, I actually did a story for tomorrow's paper on this and, you know, the possibility of a Dublin lockdown. And I spoke to a government TD who was quite aghast that it went 5 days, you know, from last Thursday when Ronan Glynn wrote the letter to the Minister for Health, and he had this advice about Dublin that went through to Tuesday, and they made the point, you know, that over 550 cases, you know, were reported over the weekend, and how many other people visited family or nursing homes in that time in good faith, you know, without this advice being passed on to them. So there is a feeling that, yeah, maybe a couple of days, maybe a day or two to see if the figures even out. But I think from Thursday to Tuesday seems a bit long. And I know that's been the feeling with the opposition as well. And now that we're hearing it from government TDs as too.
And in relation to this new body, this Martin Fraser's implementation committee that's going to be introduced. So I understand now that this week NPHET is going to deliver their advice to this body, which will then carry it through to...
Yeah, so NPHET will meet tomorrow. Then they pass the advice on to the oversight group, who then pass that on to Cabinet and the Cabinet subcommittee.
Right, okay. Because I just see a text coming through here. Ignoring NPHET to pander to business is as foolish as deregulation of banks was before the crash. Health is wealth, after all. Leave all wet pubs closed. Oh, I see. The COVID-19 oversight group was the term I was struggling to recall there as I was talking to you, Aoife. I just want to move on now to level 3, what it will mean in practice for people, Dublin people who are listening to this now. James, just very quickly, what are we doing now that we won't be able to do on Saturday if this change in the levels is confirmed?
Yeah, so my understanding of level 3, I suppose, it's limiting further the number of interactions. It doesn't mean that wet pubs can't open. It doesn't mean sporting events have to be curtailed to a smaller size. it's all that we're already doing. It's not quite come back to the level five scenario. It's not come back to the lockdown of March and April and May. It's come back to maybe early June, I suppose, to put it simply. Restricting numbers in households, you know, restricting further. And I suppose what's important is the idea of travel in and out of the county. And again, look, there was, I suppose, a bit of confusion over this the last 24, 48 hours. Again, if you have to travel, you can travel. If you need to travel for work purposes or you have a good reason, don't be foolish. Don't be taking a jaunt for the crack.
Yeah. I know, but I do have an issue with this in terms of, you know, what's a regulation, what's advice and what's, you know, for the crack.
Yeah.
Because I really want to listen to Pascal Donoghue this morning, Finance Minister Pascal Donoghue. He was on Morning Ireland this morning and he was asked about this issue, about whether or not people should travel into Dublin if they're not already in Dublin. Can they travel into Dublin at this time?
My guidance on that is until we are clearer regarding the progression of this disease, I would also be advising those who are planning to travel to Dublin to limit their travel to Dublin.
Okay, so straightforward. I'm advising people not to travel to Dublin. So a few hours later, a couple of hours later, Public Expenditure Minister Michael McGrath is on Claire Byrne's Today Show, and here's what he says about this.
The government decision and the recommendation for the people of Dublin is to encourage them to limit their travel outside of Dublin. Of course, when it comes to people from outside Dublin coming in, there is a logic to limiting that. That was not recommended by NPHET, but we all just need to use our judgment. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you do not need to travel to Dublin, then people will use their common sense.
Now, that is confusing because on one level you're being told, we're advising you, don't come into Dublin if you don't have to, if it's not essential. And then in the next outing we get from a senior minister, we're told, well, that's actually not the actual official advice from NPHET, but, you know, use your common sense. And then on another level again, we have to ask ourselves, well, which one of the, is this the law? Is this a regulation?
No.
So we've, and as I understand it, and am I right in this, James Lawless, have all the regulations that came into effect related to all the COVID-related business closures, gathering restrictions, all of that, are they all, they've all lapsed as of midnight last night? Am I incorrect in that? So there are no actual regulations in relation to these issues in place as of now?
I'm not sure as to what lapsed last night or the night before or maybe even the coming weekend. Generally, they ran up until Sunday night, so it may be up until the Sunday night. But I know that, again, I suppose taking the local lockdown at Clare Leash and Offaly, there was a new statutory instrument brought into law by the minister when that was announced. Interestingly, that statutory instrument didn't include any enforcement measures. So even though there was a statutory instrument saying this is what you're permitted to do, breach of them wasn't criminalised. So if somebody chose to go on their staycation regardless of the advice or to gather with more than 10 people in the house or whatever it was, there was no guard going to be beating down the door. And I suppose that was important from, I suppose, a buy-in point of view to an extent. But just come back to the two ministers, I actually don't see any great conflict between Minister Pascal Donoghue and Minister Michael McGrath. They're both saying the same thing. And it's effectively what I've been saying is, People are clued in. I think we have to give people credit. People know. People can see, read the news. People can see the spike in figures in Dublin. If you don't have to go to Dublin, why would you? You know, I think there has to
be. I know,
be
but that. Then why is it that NPHET actually clearly advises in writing, don't leave Dublin County if you are currently here, but doesn't make any reference at all to people arriving from elsewhere into Dublin?
Well, I wonder, was that an oversight? Because to me, it seems a little bit illogical, frankly. So I don't know if they just didn't cover that part of it. But, you know, if you're not going to go into a place, the reverse seems to hold as well. But again, you go back to people using their judgment. Sure, if you have an urgent medical work reason to be somewhere, to go somewhere, you know, that may make sense. But if you don't really, you know, hang tight for the moment for your own sake as much as anybody else.
I know, but people have all sorts of reasons to move around the counties and move to other places. Rebecca, I know your party leader today was saying, look, this has to be, can't be everyone being given the opportunity to make up their own minds about what's right and what's wrong.
Absolutely. And I think that's the problem with Tuesday, that it wasn't exactly clear what people were permitted to do and what people aren't permitted to do. And I listened to Pascal Donoghue this morning and I wasn't sure whether or not I should stay put in Dublin or whether I did have permission for other reasons to leave. One of the things, though, that I'm very concerned about is the gathering of households, which they're talking about. And particularly in Dublin, you have a quarter of people who live by themselves. They're in single person households, and their social interaction is massively limited. And it seems to me how the design of some of the restrictions and regulations that are coming out are very much built around people who are in a nuclear family unit. And I think that's a real concern, because it's not just the immediate COVID crisis that we have. I think we have an epidemic of mental health and loneliness that we have as an overhang from March. So I'm very, very concerned with that very strict interpretation of household.
It's a kind of a one-size-fits-all.
It's a one-size-fits-all, and it's a one-size-fits-all very much based on a certain model. And I think particularly in areas like Dublin, where, you know, we are moving just demographically, there's more people, elderly people are more likely to live alone as well. So I'm actually quite concerned about those regulations. There's a couple of other points that I want to raise into this. If we are moving into a level three for Dublin, we lifted an eviction ban on the basis that people could not move around. And that's what Minister Dara O'Brien said in July, that the reason that the eviction ban was able to have legal water was that we were telling people not to travel around. If the Minister for Finance and the Minister for Public Expenditure are saying that people should not leave Dublin, I think that is imperative that they immediately come in emergency legislation and reinstate that eviction ban for people who are in Dublin. Because I'm hearing of cases where people, there was a build-up of people who were being evicted. I had a briefing now from Threshold today, and double the number of people have been calling their line this year as opposed to last year. So I think there are other measures that were taken in March to be able to support that and give people support and protection that aren't being taken with these new measures that we're implementing.
If we're heading back down this road, we need to look back to what
exactly
we needed to do at that
time. And not evicting people and pushing people into homelessness would be top of my agenda on that.
Yeah, Mick.
The eviction ban was probably the most effective government policy on housing that we've seen in the last 3 years. The numbers that were officially forced to live in emergency accommodation for, I think, 7 consecutive months was more than 10,000. And with a relatively short eviction ban, the numbers went down below 10,000, below 9,500, I think, actually slightly below 9,000 at a certain point. So I think the eviction ban should be reinstated, not just for Dublin, but for the entire country as an effective policy for tackling the housing crisis. Having said that, I think that when people are communicated with clearly and given clear, strong advice, they respond to it. People understand that this virus is serious. We had mixed messages from government, and not just government, for a whole period of weeks and even months on the issue of masks. And when the messaging...
But to be fair, Mick, I mean, there was, because I followed that debate very closely, mm-hmm. there was internationally some issues around that, in terms of people, the scientists were waiting for further studies to catch up and to decide whether or not they were required, they should be mandatory or required in certain circumstances. That wasn't just an issue with the government here. We may have come at it much later than others, but there was issues in the international scientific community.
There were differing opinions in relation to that, but I think there was an emerging consensus in the scientific community before the government got its act together. I think there was a time gap there. And I think when the messaging became clearer on the base of issues being cleared up, but also on the base of the government getting their act together, people responded. In fact, people responded even before the government got their act together. The masks was kind of a movement from below. And I think it's a clear example that people take it seriously. And if there's not mixed messages, but clear messaging, people will respond. And we haven't been getting that from the government, and it's part of the problem.
Can I ask you something, respond to something that the Taoiseach said in the Dáil today? It was said yesterday as well. I understand it was brought up at the parliamentary Fianna Fáil parliamentary party meeting. In fact, I've got a text here saying, Katie, can you ask James about the comments he made about the media at the Fianna Fáil parliamentary party meeting? Trump-like. I'll get you in a minute, James. But the line that was quoted by Daniel McConnell tweeting his leaks from that Fianna Fáil parliamentary party meeting this evening was from Minister Stephen Donnelly, who hit out at opposition and media's message of confusion. He told TDs his plan is developed by experts. Opposition and media are undermining those experts, he said. You're not wearing the green jersey. You're being irresponsible, Mick.
No, I wouldn't accept that at all. I think there was confusion in the Dáil yesterday, particularly around the question of what exactly was being said in relation to Dublin. And I've given another example there from the previous government in relation to masks. This has been a feature pretty much all along the line. And it has been part of the problem. Of course, there was a big discussion and debate today about the Dáil being closed down and about Stephen Donnelly's COVID test. A lot of people were saying, well, what about the meat plants? What about the schools? Why should these people not have to wait as long as we do? I would argue to turn that argument on its head. Instead of levelling down for senior government ministers, we should be levelling up for the people in the schools and the people in the meat plants and the people in society and have speedier testing for everyone.
And I do hope we will get to that in a while. I want to go to you, Aoife Moore. Aoife, in relation to this issue about the media, James, if I'm quoting you correctly, you can tell me if Daniel McConnell is quoting you correctly in this leak. He said that James Lawless TD reportedly said that the Irish Examiner is not helpful and the Irish Indo has become a red top. Does that ring a bell with you, James, from earlier?
So I've been speaking at length and on matters of policy and substance in parliamentary party meetings for about 5 years now. And finally, someone has noticed. So thanks, Danny. But it seems like you have to actually go on the attack to get any airtime.
Do you believe the Irish Examiner is not helpful?
No, not at all. And obviously it's...
Did you say that at the meeting earlier?
I said that some of the leaks, the Examiner, and I'll give an example. So the Examiner actually, and it's a credit to them as reporters and doing their job properly, have a really good hotline into our parliamentary party meetings. And I'll just go to show, actually, I proved that point. I missed at one point, my Zoom connection was up and down during the course of the meeting. Sorry, just for context, it was a 2.5 hour long parliamentary meeting tonight. Of late, particularly increasingly so, they begin in the papers, and I suppose it is the conflicts and it is the squabbles that make the papers. It's less the policy discussions and the really good stuff that happens with them as well. But at one point, and this I think kind of proves the point, my connection dropped and I missed an announcement actually. Sean Fleming apparently is going to become the chair of the election review committee. Great, no better man, Minister Sean Fleming.
Danny McConnell very quickly tweeted that.
And I didn't know otherwise, even though I was in the meeting. So Danny was not in the meeting, knows more about what's happening in it than I do, who's a participant. Now, that's no criticism of Danny.
Are you denying
colleagues.
That you said that the Irish Examiner is not helpful and the Irish Indo has become a red top?
That kind of linkage, I think.
Because as you said a moment ago, Danny McConnell has an excellent line into, but you're saying in your case he got your quotes wrong.
I'm saying that having that kind of... line into the meeting, it's not helpful for us. It's helpful for him as a newspaper. It's helpful for him as a media person. Of course, and he's absolutely entitled to report whatever he wants to report. But it's unhelpful to our party. Now, that's fine. It's my job to defend my party and it's his job to publish the news. And there shouldn't generally be a conflict. But I would point at the other 14 minutes and 50 seconds worth of contribution that I gave and ask if his line is good enough, maybe he'll pull a few quotes out of that as well, because I made a lot of substantial contributions about the Dublin lockdown, about the Kildare lockdown.
I want to let Aoife in. Aoife, and I saw the Taoiseach had a go at the Examiner on primetime last night in relation to a story that you had on the front of the paper yesterday.
Yeah, we're making friends with all sides. Kidding.
Do you want to just explain what that story was and what the Taoiseach said in relation to it last night?
Yeah, so it was actually in Kildare. The Taoiseach, we met in a gym. He was announcing business supports for Kildare and we had a press conference after it. And at one point in the press conference, his quote was, "Hope is on the horizon." And then he began to talk about a COVID vaccine. And he said that, I think he said, no, I don't quote him directly, confident or optimistic, that we could begin vaccinating the elderly, the vulnerable and healthcare workers in the first half of next year. He offered no scientific basis or anything after it. And the press conference went on. And when we were all outside, there was a few journalists and a few photographers and we all kind of noted, like, never heard that before. So I can't just publish things, you know, as fact and, you know, give people hope or whatever about this vaccine. So I went and spoke to two different people in the Department of Health and I said, you know, are you confident that we'll start vaccinating people in the new year? And one of the sources replied, vaccinating them for what? So I think that just shows you how shocked they were to hear it. So two different sources said, not something I'm aware of. And another source said, well, we're planning the next 69 months with this living for COVID plan. So if the Taoiseach knows something that we don't, that would be great. I mean, I'm sure everyone would love a vaccine. But he wasn't too pleased about it. And
I think we have a clip of when he was asked about this on primetime last night.
We're increasingly confident that we'll see a vaccine in the first half of the new year. First half of the new year is sometime between now and June of next year, and that is what the World Health Organization is projecting. It's what the acting CMO has said to us. It wasn't even news in any other newspaper, by the way, but the Examiner managed to find an anonymous official who thought by the middle of the new year that I meant January. I never said January.
Yeah, Natasha wasn't reading the papers correctly because it was in the Indo as well.
And as you say, it wasn't just one anonymous official.
Yeah, it was two.
It was two. Okay, but there is a pattern here, though, isn't there, in terms of the government kind of turning it back on the opposition now, basically saying the opposition aren't doing opposition right and the media are not being helpful.
Yeah, and I think what we're seeing more and more, you know, we keep saying there's mixed messages and confusion coming from government, and then the government keeps turning around and saying, no, this is very clear. If people keep telling you that a message is confused, maybe you need to start listening to them by saying, no, it's not us, it's you, you're not listening properly. And we have opposition TDs and government TDs are coming out and saying, we need to get on the message. I spoke to a cabinet minister today and I said, is there concern about the mixed message? When yous were in cabinet the other day, did anyone put up their hand and say, we have to get this right because we're starting to lose the public when it comes to messaging? And they said, no, we really thought, you know, the Living with COVID plan is really good. It's laid out really clearly. We had a special early cabinet meeting. We were going to have an early press conference. It was going to be great. And he said, when ministers then started going on broadcast, that's when it started falling apart, because there was questions that clearly had gone unanswered when they were, I don't know, debating this among themselves or explaining it among themselves that they weren't expecting. And then that's why we see contradictions from different ministers when they go on different programmes. So I do think maybe, you know, it's a three-party government. We're in the middle of a pandemic. Everyone's getting settled in behind their desks. And I believe that there's a lack of communication within the government, and that is leading to bad communication when it comes to COVID guidelines.
Yeah, I see here that Gavin O'Reilly has tweeted in response to that comment from Minister Donnelly, that reported comment from Minister Donnelly that the opposition and media were undermining the experts. Gavin O'Reilly responds, the media aren't the ones who conducted a 52-minute press conference without listing the five Dublin-specific restrictions, publish a list which only get four of them, and then go on radio to say, unqualified, that Dubliners absolutely can leave the county. And we will leave that there. We'll take a break, but after the break, we'll be asking, were high achievers sacrificed in the name of educational equality?
The Late Debate with Katie Hannan on RTE Radio 1.
And you're welcome back to Wednesday's Late Debate. Now, today, the first legal challenge to the calculated grade system for this year's Leaving Cert came before the High Court. In a moment, we'll be talking to David Lockery, an English teacher from Bruce College in Cork. But first, I want to go to Aoife D'Arcy, who is CEO of the data analysis firm Chrysalis, who is commissioned by the Institute of Education in Dublin to analyse the impact the algorithm used to calculate the grades had on student grades. Aoife, welcome to the programme.
Thank you, Katie.
What did you find when you analysed the data and the impact of this algorithm?
Yeah, so I suppose I was asked into the Institute last week to have a look at, they were very concerned that their grades had been overly impacted by the algorithm that was put in place in the calculated grades process. And I suppose they've 24 subjects. They have over 800 students, there was 4,000 grades, so there's a lot of data for me to analyse. And after much to-ing and fro-ing, it became very obvious that in subjects where they tended to historically overachieve, so like French, for instance, that their grades were disproportionately adjusted by the model.
Right.
So, for example,
Yeah, I was just going to say, without bamboozling people with numbers, which is a terrible thing to say to a data analyst, but just say in that French case, what could they have expected to have happened and what actually happened with their students this year?
So if you compare the 2019 figures, in 2019, 27% of their students got H1s. If you compare that to the national average, it was 7%. So this year, their percentage went down to 16%, so it went from 27% down to 16%, whereas the national average actually increased. up to 8%.
So how many H1s was that lost, basically, to the student cohort?
In or about 40. So they've quite a large French class. So there's about 40 students who, had they taken their Leaving Cert in 2019, would have expected to get a H1, who, based on the model and the adjustment that the model applied, didn't get it.
And is this a specific problem for schools? Like, obviously, the Institute of Education is what we call a grind school. So they would have clusters of very, very high H1 numbers in particular subjects.
Yeah.
And I suppose you'd see that. I know that Killian's, the German school up here in Clonsky in Dublin, that also had an issue because they would have had high numbers, obviously, of people, students who would speak German as their first language. And they were they were very adversely hit as well. And I assume Gaelscoileanna would have had a similar issue.
Yeah, so I think anywhere. So I think St Killian's, I think they went from 41% H1s down to 14%. And I think what it was, I would say that those examples are very stark. They're very obvious. There's probably, you know, classes right across the country where they overperform in certain subjects, you know, margin, maybe a little bit more or a little bit less, they still would have been affected. So anywhere where you have, you know, like a good physics teacher in a school, wherever, it's quite likely that their grades were disproportionately adjusted as well. I suppose with these examples, it's quite stark, so it's really obvious.
And was this something that just happened there in those last few weeks when there was the big furore about the algorithm that changed grades in the UK? Was that where when this was introduced? If that hadn't happened, would this have been not an issue?
So there's a very detailed 200-page document issued by the government with lots of statistical analysis in it. I suppose one thing it does state that the removal of the historical grades or the historical performance definitely affected accuracy. So basically the model became less accurate. Now, it doesn't state by how much or where. And without actually seeing the original model, it's hard to say exactly how much it would have affected it. But I think I don't know if it would have fixed it completely, but it certainly would have helped. So it's kind of hard to say without seeing the original model.
And of course,
start with it in there.
That is the issue in this, of course, then, is because some of the data was destroyed. The appeals process is very limited.
Yeah, I think so. For me, I suppose we work across industry and we look at kind of areas where statistical models are embedded into all sorts of processes. And you always expect error. So one thing that kind of surprised me was once you introduce a statistical model of any description, you're going to introduce error. So had the model have been devised differently, we may be talking about a different cohort of students who were disproportionately adjusted by the way that model would have worked. So no matter what model they chose or they landed on, it was always going to be wrong somewhere, because that's what happens when you introduce statistics. There's, you know, any poll that gets produced always has a margin of error with it. You expect error.
Mm-hmm.
So generally in processes, so if you think in credit scoring and banking, there's kind of lots of, when a mortgage, somebody applies for a mortgage, there's a statistical model that predicts their likelihood that they're going to repay that loan. Now, the lender has the ability to adjust that. So if they think that the model isn't working and they have some extra data, they can actually kind of change the decision based on that model. I suppose here, I was really surprised that the appeals process was actually reduced this year, because once you introduce that error, no matter what model was going to be the final model, it was always going to be wrong. So should there not have been a more robust extended appeals process
rather than the reduced one that we have? Okay, Aoife, I'm going to leave you go. Thank you so much for bringing us that and explaining the detail of that to us. But we're joined now from our Cork studio by David Lockery, who teaches English in Bruce College in Cork. Good evening, David.
Good evening, Katie. Thanks for having me.
what Aoife was saying there, that, you know, once you introduce any sort of a statistical model on these results, somebody had to lose out. Mm. And in this case, it happened to be the high achieving students.
Yes. I suppose, Katie, you know, the discussion the last number of weeks has been about, you know, the calculated grade model and the fallout of that. And there was no easy, model or methodology to approach it. But I think we have to go back, Katie, a few months ago into June, when the department set out the criteria by which we would assess our students. So the department at the beginning were taking, the last 3 years, basically, of a school's results and performance into account. And in Bruce College, like many schools across the country...
And just to explain to me, Bruce College is like the Institute of Education. It's we call a grind school.
Well, it's what the media and the public call a grind school, but we would consider it's a private school.
Yeah.
But back in June, when this all kicked off, we were asked by the department and to put grades together for our students. And basically what we had to do was we had to create a system in our classes from top to bottom. And, you know, as a result of that, we spent weeks. I went through multiple grades and essays to get a really, really accurate grade for my students. And, you know, basically, what would they get as honestly as possible?
But, you know, I saw this. So just on that point, and I know you're on the way to saying something else, but just on that point, there was the case made, and I heard it several times on that week when the results came out or the calculated grades came out, that, you know, teachers gave the results that they would have, they thought a student might get on their best day. That they were generous, basically, in that. And isn't a teacher inclined to be generous in these circumstances?
Well, there's no doubt, Katie. Like, you know, every teacher has their students' best interests at heart, and you want to give them benefit of the doubt. But unfortunately, I think that, you know, with the parameters the actual department set out, we actually did it so honestly and fairly from top to bottom. So, you know, I would have graded, you know, there's 160 students plus, five classes, and you grade them from 1 to 24 or 25 in each class. The problem was, Katie, that when we submitted those grades, after that, the department changed the criteria. So they got rid of school profiling and they decided to take their junior cert results, etc., into account. So basically, we submitted their grades on the premise that it was based on and aligned with the school's performance for the last 3 years. Once that changed, I knew immediately that our grades were going to be adversely affected as a result. And that's basically what happened.
But if they hadn't done that, isn't the difficulty that people at the other end of the scale would have had seen their grades adversely affected?
Well,
people who are going to school may be high achieving students,
yes,
but happen to be in a school where historically the grades hadn't been at that level.
But I think that's where, Katie, where you have to trust your teachers. You know, the teachers know the students best. Every teacher knows intimately their students from the point of view of their grading, from teaching them over a year,
yeah,
2 years.
But David, that wouldn't have mattered if the algorithm came in then, and because that school didn't historically have this level of grades, would have reduced that teacher's grade for their students anyway.
But what the department should have done was, you know, they waited for what happened in England and Scotland and Wales. They saw what happened there, and then they decided to change the parameters at the last moment. You know, so there's no point in creating one set of parameters and then changing without any consultation whatsoever. There was zero consultation, no due diligence, nothing. They changed the model, and then there was no recourse back or discussion with the department after that.
Okay, will you stay there? Because
yep.
Mick Barry's trying to get in here. He's waving at me. Mick.
Yeah, thanks. I think the decision to cancel the Leaving Cert was a correct decision on mental health grounds, if nothing else. I think that the decision to scrap school profiling was also a positive decision because I think there would have been discrimination against young people from working class areas in particular, and perhaps especially bright students in those schools.
But is it any better if the discrimination is against middle class kids in middle class areas?
I think the solution is to create more places in third level. For the last number of years, 78% of students have gotten one of their top three CAO places. And in order to bring it up to 78% this year with grade inflation, the government have had to create an extra 5,000 places in third level. And I think the solution now is to go beyond that. Every young person who sat the exams who wants to go to college should be able to go to college. They may not get their first choice, but if they don't get their first choice, they should get their second or third. And that can only be done on the basis of creating more places. Although I would make the point that I hear what the grind schools are saying, that they feel the results have been skewed a bit because of an algorithm. But, you know, I didn't hear the grind schools making the point that the results in all previous years have been skewed on the basis of who has the money to be able to send their children to the grind schools in the first place. That's skewed results for quite a long time.
Okay, and I'll let you back in on that, David, but Rebecca just wants to chip in here.
I think we need to actually talk about the cancelling of the Leaving Cert and the impact that it had, and the cancelling of the Junior Cert and the impact that it had. I don't think the Leaving Cert should have been cancelled. Mm. And we were the only party that said that the Leaving Cert shouldn't be cancelled. The Junior Cert also shouldn't have been cancelled, because you have people, the only piece of paper that they will come out with is the Junior Cert. And nobody is talking about those students, that that's the only qualification that they might come out of in school. There's also 1,000 students that didn't sign up to the predicted grades in the Leaving Cert. And like, scrapping the school modelling profile was absolutely the right decision to do. I was talking to myself and Aon at this stage in June, was talking to a principal in a Dash school. She had said it was a different cohort of students this year to last year, but also that they had, as part of the continuous improvement in the school, had reintroduced transition year, and so they weren't able to go back 3 years because they had missed one Leaving Cert year.
Okay,
and
so
I don't
students were protected with this decision, but David's students and other students in those schools were the sacrificial lambs then, weren't they?
Aoife said any statistical model that you have, there will be people who are disadvantaged by it. Mm-hmm. And my point is that we shouldn't have cancelled the Leaving Cert. We were beginning to open up at that stage, and we could have done the Leaving Cert the difference with disadvantage.
To use the worst phrase alive, we are where we are. We were where we were. The Leaving Cert was cancelled. You were part, Aon O'Riordan and Labour and Mick and others campaigned very strongly to have that school profiling element taken out of the algorithm. But you didn't think about the impact that would have then on the other end of the
scale. There are structural disadvantages for people going to Dash schools that will carry them around a lot longer than the Leaving Cert. And school profiling was an absolutely disgraceful thing to introduce. And I'm glad that it was scrapped. Okay. Because if you were a high-performing student in a deaf school, you would have been disproportionately affected by this. But we shouldn't have, and I think we have to have a debate about the students who didn't get a Junior Cert, and also the status of this Leaving Cert. Like, the legal advice...
I want to get David back, fair, because he's in a different studio again. David, just those two points. One is that it was absolutely the right thing to do, that people who were disadvantaged already were going to be further disadvantaged if that had stayed as part of the algorithm. And then Mick's point that, you know, this is 1 year in which this cohort of students are disadvantaged, when in every other year they have a significant advantage over many other students in the system.
Yeah, it's very easy to say it's 1 year. When you're a teacher working with students on a daily basis, when you see the sacrifices that they make, when you see the commitment that they make, right through COVID all the way to May, doing live classes, doing homework, you know, doing everything that's asked of them. And, you know, you see the last 10 days then, the disappointment, the absolute, you know, the upset that it has created. Because it seems to me that it's OK to absolutely, you know, sacrifice high achieving students. OK, it just seems to be, you know, there's no argument because that they'll settle. They'll be quiet. They're the minority. They're the privileged group. They're not very vocal. You know, this was not the group who applied pressure to cancel the exam. I agree the exams should not have been cancelled. But this cohort of students, they didn't want to cancel them. They wanted to do the exam.
But is it not the case, and I just got a text here on exactly this point, grades are adjusted every year. You send your corrected scripts to your supervising examiner, and if the bell curve is off, then the marking scheme is changed and downgrades happen. People are downgraded. The only difference this year is that the whole thing happened in the full public glare.
Yeah. Absolutely. But I think the problem, Katie, here is it's the magnitude of the deflation that has taken place.
Okay, James is trying to get in.
Yeah, I just think the point about the bell curve is really important, because normally what happens is there is a normalisation and there's external examiners, and ultimately whether, and actually to an extent it doesn't matter from one year to the next if the entire set of grades are up by 5% or down by 5%, because it's that group of students that are going for places are competing against each other.
Yeah, but David's point is that it was... There's a huge impact on a small cohort.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's because the bell curve doesn't sufficiently reflect what I suppose I'd call blocks or spikes in the system. So that small number of places where you have a school that typically has a high profile of results, and the bell curve doesn't actually catch that. And
so
I'm hearing David correctly, I think David's issue really is that his scoring model and his teachers, the model they approached to grading, anticipated a particular approach being used afterwards, which was the school profiling. And then when that was taken away, they'd already submitted their results, or their scores, and that was taken away. So I suppose in a way they tried to work with the system, but the system changed midstream. So I could see the frustration in that. There is an option. I mean, it's not ideal, but any student that isn't satisfied can sit it again. There are the option of resits in November. I get that there's a wait for
taking place. But you lose your place this year?
No, I get that. I get that completely.
Look, study life gone.
No solution was ever going to be perfect. Again, it's dealing with
but just dealing with that point that David said there, that we had a huge hue and cry, and rightly so, when the school profiling issue emerged as something that could seriously disadvantage already disadvantaged school students. But people are quite like, oh well, shrug the shoulders when it's.
I think it's unfair to label every student in a private school as somehow an elite or somehow overprivileged. That's not the case either. I mean, I know so many students, even in my own constituency, that got on buses up to Dublin early in the morning. Parents made sacrifices to afford the fees, and children as well. So I do think it's very hard. I think that it was expected that maybe children at the other end might lose out. Thankfully, that didn't happen. But it's no compensation to say maybe children at the high end lost out. That's not good either.
Well, this will be decided in the courts. It won't be decided in the studio. I understand there's going to be more court action beyond the case that we heard today. Just before we go, we have another 5 minutes to go. Will you stay there, David? Because I want to touch on this with you before we go. It's in relation to the testing issue. Because what happened yesterday, Stephen Donnelly... we hear that he has to get a test, and then just within a few hours he has had the test and the result is back, and thankfully it's negative. And it just some people complaining about the fact that other people, but I think Mick, you made the point that why can't we have an aim for everybody to get that kind of a turnaround time, because there is no doubt that if you have a situation where it's taking days and days for tests to be arranged, done, and to be tested, that's going to be a huge disincentive for people to put themselves forward for testing, particularly if it happens more than once. Can you go to your boss again and say, sorry, I have to be out now for another 3 or 4 days while I'm waiting for the test to happen? Where are we with that, James? Do you know? I mean, we had that target, 72 hours, because we were told after that, it's a problem that your contacts have gone on and affected other people.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think we've tested a million people at this stage. Our million tests have been carried out. I think Stephen Donnelly, half joking, half in earnest, said at the Parliamentary Party tonight he might have been the millionth tested person. Unlike Ryanair, he doesn't get a lifetime of free flights. But... the testing is all important. I think there was a move maybe towards coming into the end of June, start of July, that testing was being centralised back into the centres. I know the Aviva Stadium was catering for the surrounding counties, and it was acting as a blocker to testing because people didn't, there shouldn't be any incentives. I also know that some of the private out-of-hours services were actually charging patients for referrals, an issue I got onto locally, and indeed it was mirrored around the country. That shouldn't be happening. Any barriers to testing, the HSE, the government have made clear, there should be no blocked testing, there should be no price for testing. It should be free, including a free referral, including out of hours, be it private or public service that you go to. So I think we're getting there. I think we actually are. I think the numbers are being tested.
We're getting there a long time. I mean, if we just waste all those hours in the summertime when the numbers went down and we could have been planning and putting all this
infrastructure in place. A lot of tests. I'm not a medic, but a million people is a lot of people to test. So I think it's not small. Do we get to the stage? I think South Korea, they start to try to test everybody. That would be 5 million tests. We're not doing that. We haven't taken that approach. We're not going for zero COVID, but we are ramping up testing as many places as we possibly can.
I want to bring in Aoife.
Hello.
The The testing regime across in Northern Ireland is slightly different to here, isn't it?
Yeah, so the way it works in the north, I'm originally from Derry, and I know from friends and family that you don't have to go through a GP. So for in Derry City, for instance, you can ring up. It's held in the testing centres in the local rugby club. And if you're feeling unwell, and I know people who have come back from foreign travel who were feeling paranoid, and one of my friends lives with one of her grandparents and she'd been in isolation, but she was still afraid about going back into her granddad's house, and she was able to book and go over and get the test, and then she had her results, I think, within 24 hours. So it is different up there. It's a lot more accessible. I know the government have said that we can't do that because they're afraid of overwhelming the labs and, you know, the staff there in the testing centres. But it has been made, the point has been made by the opposition, and we've seen it across Europe now that there are countries that are moving towards rapid testing, and it really opens up the country in terms of connectivity and lockdowns and different things like that.
Okay, I just want to have only a minute left, and I wanted to put that to David. What's happening in Bruce College in relation to this? Have you had students or staff needing tests?
No, none. In fairness to Micheál Landers, the principal, and the staff, they were basically in the school the entire summer. We've a great system of, we've staggered starts for classes. We have staggered breaks. We record every single class live on video. So if a child is sick and they're worried about, you know, potentially having any symptoms, etc., you know, every child gets a sent a video of the classes they have missed. So I think that's a fantastic system that, you know, kids don't feel that, you know, that if I'm not in school today, I'm going to miss out on a whole lot, so I'm gonna risk it, and that seems to be working really well. But we have a one way system as well in the school, and to be honest with you, Katie, I 10 days back, really, I think the kids are actually delighted to be back, and okay. I know I'm as a teacher delighted to be back as well.
Okay, and I'm sure a lot of parents out there are delighted everyone's back as well. David, I'm going to have to leave that there. Thank you for joining us. Thank you to all my guests in studio here, and to even the studio down the corridor, and to all of you for listening. That's all from us for tonight. The programme was produced by Caroline Dalton. Research was by Andrew Fleming. The broadcast coordinator was Elaine Conlon, and Dave Gibson was on sound. Now it's over to Colm Murray on Late Day.